Croeso and welcome to Tales for Wales, the pod that never fails to give you the finest vintages of Welsh history, to give you that rich soil-like flavour from the earth of Wales herself, and give off the unique aroma of a mostly accurate history podcast. I'm Jack, and as usual, I'm joined by my chief sommelier, I hope I've said that right, Franco.
Absolutely.
And today, And today we're joined by a couple of new voices, Sarah and Angie. Welcome to the pod, both.
Hiya.
Hi, guys.
Did we get sommelier right?
By the way.
No.
Sommelier, yeah. Oh, also it's Sarah, not Sarah.
Sarah, sorry.
Great start. Absolutely.
Jesus Christ. I said to Franks before we came up, we were on this for about 10 minutes before, and I said, what's their names? Make sure I don't get them wrong. Yeah. And I just copied exactly what he said, so I'm very sorry.
Throwing me under the bus. Absolutely throwing me under the bus.
I will not go down like a dog with you. There's no chance.
Also, we're not very sophisticated, so wine is above our standards. But absolutely. Sommelier, we winged it with sommelier.
Don't
there.
Worry, we're not sophisticated either.
It was good research there, finding a wine term.
Yeah.
I really liked the intro.
Did you notice soil-like flavour from the earth? Because yeah. I googled that before I wrote it, so apparently that's a thing.
Soil-like flavour, I really enjoy the taste of soil.
Yeah,
I was going to say, wine like dirt, my favourite, yeah.
So we'll go into some questions in a little bit, but do you guys want to introduce yourselves so people at home can hear who you are?
So I'm Sarah. I am the owner of Fyn Van Cymru, which is a wine shop and tasting events company based in Cardiff. And then Angela is my partner in crime.
Like what you did there.
Oh, I see. I got it.
I bring the crime to her wine. So I'm Angela Muir. I'm a historian, actually an associate professor of history at a university that probably should remain nameless just in case I say anything incriminating during this. No, I'm actually a professional historian. I work at the University of Leicester, even though I live in Cardiff and specialize in Welsh history. But I research gender and crime and deviance in Wales in the 18th century. So I bring the crime.
Wow.
And I bring the wine.
You've both got credentials. I like it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're now redundant. We were just enthusiastic drunk.
We might as well hang up on the call, just let you guys take it.
We'll hand
all
over.
Part of our plan.
So you both work together on Wines and Crimes. People who follow us on socials will probably have seen some of the promo we've shared of your stuff. But in case they haven't, would you want to give us an idea to start with? So what gave you the idea to start with Wines and Crimes? Was it like a specific moment? Sorry.
Franks, I think you've skipped too far ahead, mate. We haven't asked anyone what they're drinking yet. The classic intro.
I'm so sorry. I am. I brought shame upon the pod.
You've made a sham of this whole thing.
I got scared by their credentials. It was just so impressive instantly.
Had to make instantly try and make it more like professional. Yeah.
Hello. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Good point.
Just have a drink. You'll be all right.
We're crumbling under the pressure. Angie, do you want to start with what you're drinking?
Yeah, so actually Sara and I are drinking the exact same thing, and we're both, so I'm Canadian, so what I'm about to say is what we say in Canada. This is, don't worry. So we're both double fisting. I think you call it double parking here.
For obvious reasons.
So something Sara and I like to do is sometimes get like a really nice bottle of wine and then get something that's similar but a lot cheaper or a lot more inexpensive. Less expensive. And so for the fancy one, we've gone with a lovely Welsh rosé, which is a Lladyr. Nice. And then we've got another rosé that is from a company you may have heard of, Lidl.
Oh, yes.
Talking about Lidl. A supermarket.
Yeah,
it's Lidl. Supermarket rosé from Lidl. Sorry, I can tell you a bit more about what they actually are.
They're both rosés.
Done.
Next.
This wine stuff's a piece of piss. Yeah.
the Welsh, yeah. Well, I don't want to give away too much about the Welsh first, because we may talk about that a bit later on.
We've basically
got a Welsh rosé. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. Comparing it with a Portuguese rosé and just drinking two drinks at the same time.
It's a great excuse, isn't it? Just go, look, it's a nice pairing. Basically, I want to do the double fisting, yeah.
I might join you, actually. I might get, because I'm drinking a fine Danish Pilsner called Carlsberg, but I might pair it. Ooh. Yeah, I might pair it with the Carling. But this is also my first time drinking in 2025, and it's been a long month, so I'm so excited. Because
well done.
Yeah, so today's my end of my dry Jan. I'm on Carlsberg. Yeah, and I'm going to get a Carling now.
He's really been through the ringer because as someone who's been on the receiving end of his text this entire month, it's all that it's been is going, should we plan a sesh for Feb? Should we do something for Feb? Should we do something for anything for Feb?
I've made so many plans for Feb, it's outrageous. I haven't got a second to breathe.
You're going to be fuming now in this next month because you're going to have to go to so many events that you've racked up.
Well, I've not got
you for managing the entire month. Most people don't.
I found out no one else does. Everyone else who started with it's like, no, I can't be bothered.
But I was about to say, you're looking at one of the failures right here.
And also, Jack committed. Jack said, right, I won't do dry jam, but I just won't have pints. I'll ease up on pints. And that lasted about a day before he was like, all right, no.
At least a week and a half, right? But that's because I went to go see my mate Andy, or our mate Andy, and we went to the pub, and he said, come on, pub's different. And I was like, that's all the amount of convincing I needed, really.
Yes. So what are you drinking, Jim?
I thought you were going to say you gave up on the pints, but you're just like raw dogging tequila.
Oh, well, that was the plan. God, yeah. Can imagine. You were going to be on the rum. That was the only thing you were having, wasn't it? But that fell aside. Mm.
So what Canadians have got some quite aggressive words about drinking.
I was going to say, if you're doing like,
double fisting and raw dogging.
Sexual terminology bingo, you've already got two on your card.
Sorry.
No, we're here for it. It's all good. I'm on the Carlsberg as well, actually. I had a couple of Coors. I've got an absolute Frankenstein's monster of a beer fridge at the moment, just leftover tidbit. So I had some Coors Light earlier, Carlsbergs, and then I've got some very cheap looking spiced rum liqueur with roasted pineapple, and it doesn't even have like a brand name on it. I think I had it for Christmas or something. Oh, here we go, Manchester Drinks Company, you know, the big one that everyone knows.
In Canada, an orgy of beers, they'd call that, I assume.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I tailored that down from being too sexually aggressive.
Leave that to me.
Yeah. Well, should we start off with our very mature interview? Because what we're going to do here is ask a few questions about how it all started. And then we're going to get a little example at the end of what the Wines and Crimes Nights involves. So, yeah, first off, what gave you the idea to start Wines and Crimes? And was there a specific moment that made you think we have to do this?
Well, funnily enough, we didn't come up with a concept. It was a mutual friend of ours, Aidan, who knew Angela. This is actually before we were friends. Not
were
that
you
we were
enemies. Savage enemies.
Wine and crime never used to get on.
No, we didn't know each other, but we had a mutual friend, and she used to come to a lot of my wine tastings. And she was like, oh my God, my friend Angela, you guys should get together because she has all these amazing true crime stories that she tells me about over a glass of wine. And I think it would be a really good concept. And she said, and I've also got the name for you. It's Wines and Crimes. So if you ever monetize it properly, I want shares.
I can see the genesis there as well. And she'd be over a glass of wine. You went, hang on a minute, ears perking up. Wine, you say?
It's well, my domain.
It's exactly what happened. And we got together and started drinking a lot of wine and just going over ideas and stuff. And it wasn't until, because at the time I had a unit in Newport Market. I don't know if you guys have been. I'm
amazing.
Not there anymore, so
yeah, it's great.
It's less amazing now that I'm not there, obviously.
Yes,
of course.
Yeah. Actually, I hate it. I forgot to say I hate Newport Market. Yeah.
It's really gone downhill
it
recently.
It used to be great, yeah.
No, it's a great space. So the manager took me down to the basement. Hang on, this is coming out wrong.
This is where the crime
comes. He said, tell no one. Yeah.
I think out of curiosity, I wanted to see what was down there. And they basically have the vaults, the original vaults from back in the day. And they've got the original caging that they used to use to keep cattle and stuff. And even prisoners, if the prisons were overflowing. And it was like genuinely the eeriest place I've ever been. It was no electricity, no heating. And like, you just constantly felt like there was something behind you. And I was like, actually, if we're talking wines and crimes, we're going to have to use this space. And that's kind of what really brought it together, I think. Yeah. Yeah. That was the very first few events that we put together. And it, I think it did quite well. Just having that space to start off with.
And Newport.
And Angela's just like, yeah, in Newport,
It's great as well. Like, Newport's so rich in history, and it's got like quite a lot of, you know, like the Newport uprising and stuff like that. It's like all the streets there feel like they all tell a story. And Newport Market is great. I do love it. And what was your first one on? What was the very first Wines and Crimes night?
The first one was a Halloween event.
Mm-hmm. I think actually the example we're going to give you in a little bit was from that first event.
Oh, cool.
I think you're right, actually.
Because we basically leaned into creepy, gruesome.
We had the ideal space for it, sounds
scary. I mean, literally, Angela would be down there, and I would pretend lock people into a vault, and then just kind of walk down, and then every now and again would just scream or like just like throw something in the distance and just get people like, to jump.
I think you actually had waivers. I think the first two we did, you made people sign waivers because we were down in the cellars, and it's like there's no lighting. It was all lit by candles. There's no emergency.
I was just gonna say, did you have to have some sort of like caveats on these events saying like you might be scared shitless?
The thing is, if you are scared shitless, there's no toilet down there. Like
it was a logistical nightmare, and it was the Newport Market management team that I said, please let me do this event. They're like, you're gonna need, we need signatures, we need it on record, we need it on file. And then we had to have a protocol of how to get everyone down those really, really narrow, like the steep steps. So it would
bloody
all be very well lit getting everyone down, and then we would just shut the lights off and you could just feel everyone shit their pants.
And I mean, it would have been less of a problem without the wine, but like by the time everyone's coming back up, they've had like three glasses of wine.
I thought that you were going to say that either they all shit themselves, they come back up and you go, you probably need a drink after that, don't you? Here's my bottle of wine, you can buy right from me.
We'd rather that not go on TripAdvisor, so we can either confirm nor deny.
Sorry, we can edit
imagine the reviews.
You've never had so much fun shitting yourself.
You're marketing genius, it's unreal.
Create the demand, I like it.
So that was sounds like a bit of a challenge finding the space, but what were the other obstacles from getting it to being a proper event from like concept to execution?
It's actually been pretty smooth in a lot of ways, because like true crime is such a popular genre right now, and everybody loves drinking wine. So it's just been a matter of getting the word out, but it's done really, really well, and it promotes itself in a lot of ways especially through like social media.
And I think, I mean, partly the way that our process is basically, you know, you come up with some sort of an idea or a theme or whatever it is. And we will sometimes, I mean, every now and again, we were like, oh, my God, we've got all the content and I've got the wines already. Brilliant. You know, and it doesn't take that long. But more often than not, it is a lengthy process of one that we enjoy, where we just sit and we will polish off more bottles of wine than we probably should and talk about, because I'm just like, I've got the story and it's really, really great. And I'm like, oh my God, that reminds me of this wine. And then we'll talk about, oh, but if I was in an event, you know, how long would I want to sit down for and how many wines would I want? Yeah. It's trying to work out what people want as well as what we have to offer. So it's a natural process. We always come to a natural conclusion, don't we? Like, we're just like, oh, and this story, and then this story, and this wine, and this wine. Oh, there we go. We've got it done.
So, and sometimes, well, sometimes there's been a few of them. I think like the last one we did back in October, which had like ghost stories tied to the crimes as well. Like for that, I think is a good example of how sometimes we go really, really far with sort of the creative side of things and brainstorming and come up with some like over the top ideas that would be amazing to execute. But this is, at the end of the day, it's just the two of us. Sometimes with some friends coming in to help on the night, it's like, we can't possibly execute that, but that is no pun intended, but that is like an amazing idea. So a lot of the creative process is going really, really far with it and then reining it back in to what's actually reasonable for us to be able to do on the night.
Best way to do it. Yeah. I was just going to say that the idea of just, drinking quite a lot of alcohol and then coming up with ideas will resonate with me and Frank's quite heavily.
Yeah.
So this whole entire venture is based on is based on that.
Yeah. If anything, it's just like a byproduct. It's just just a coincidence. Yeah. Podcast now exists for me.
We'd be doing this anyway. It's just yeah. now that we record now, things and talk about history a bit. Yeah.
So for us, like, Wales plays a big part in our in the whole feature of the podcast. But how does Wales like play a role in your winery and crimery?
All of the crimes are Welsh. So in my proper academic research, I use the records from, it was a highest criminal court in Wales between the 1530s and the 1830s when they were abolished. So it was the Court of Great Sessions. All of these records are held at the National Library of Wales in Aberystwyth. And awesome. I use these records for like proper serious academic research, asking proper serious, sometimes boring academic questions. But the detail in these records, and especially the pretrial records, so things like depositions and witness statements where it's after a crime has been reported, it's the evidence gathering process. In Wales, those have survived in huge, huge quantity. So they're amazing, so much better than in England.
So you don't just use the top three search results on Google. You don't do that.
Well,
God, we need to step up our game.
This is interesting.
But yeah, so all of the crimes are Welsh. I think I've only mentioned one English crime, and that was at our Pride event we did back in the summer. But yeah, everything's...
Sorry, everyone gets Welsh. One.
Yeah. Okay. Everyone gets one.
We had to talk about that one.
Serious sure? words were said. Sure? Yeah.
But because I use the Court of Great Sessions, when... the Tudors divvied up Wales into the counties and then split them into the circuits for the Great Sessions. There were 13 counties, but they could only divide it by in, like 12 because there's four circuits with three counties each. So they just shoved Monmouthshire with England.
Oh,
so that's where that comes from. Yeah, you have to look at English records to get at Monmouthshire. Although I have one really good one. I think we're going to tie in to our next session because it's too good not to use. Involves a woman nicknamed Cardiff Mary.
Yeah,
all I'll say about that.
Yeah, don't give that away.
No, that's all I'll give. That's all I'll give.
We do, because we've done a few, we've done a couple of different Halloween ones. We've done a couple of like Valentine's based where, partners murder each other and that kind of thing. And then occasionally we'll come up with something a little different, like we did the Pride one, which was really, really fun because nobody died. Do you remember? It was a really joyous event because we didn't have to talk.
Nobody was murdered and nobody was executed. No, everyone,
and that's
I mean, they're dead now, but
as much as it's a fun event, you do also have to be quite respectful because
they're
true crimes.
I've said on this podcast a few times that I struggle with like modern day true crimes because I always think, well, there's a family attached to that lady who's been killed. And I always struggle with like making a murderer, like, you're having, there's entertainment at the death of someone. So I love this because it's history. So like, me and Jack talk about like battles or like things from the past where in reality a war is horrible and terrifying, but because you're separated from it. So I think your stuff is, that's why I'm really interested in it, because you feel like, it's no one alive today still remembers this person. So there's not that same kind of like, I feel like it's actual history, human thing.
Yeah, that time, like that time creates a distance that makes it feel a little bit better talking about it. But there are some topics that, I've researched extensively for work that we won't touch for Wines and Crimes.
No.
So things like infanticide, not touching that for fun. That's horrible. Anything to do with kids, anything to do with sexual violence, those sorts of things. Like,
keep them off your podcast, but bring them up in ours. Is it? You're trying to hang us or something?
I'm so sorry.
But yeah, basically, like, basic. I mean, the short note of it is like basically no rape or dead babies and Wines and Crimes.
That's our policy as well.
Generally, a good rule.
Yeah, there we go.
That's our policy.
Or anywhere for that matter. I mean, none of those anywhere. Yeah. Except maybe on my CV, but it is
a delicate thing, And in the past, we've done, in the end, that we do a final drink to discuss, the big reveal. So what happened to the people in the stories, and also why I've paired the wines with the crimes, because that's also like it's massive guesswork. The links can be tenuous at best. Mm. And it's always a bit of a game, but we will do a toast, and it's not toasting like, oh yeah, you died. It's kind of like, we've had to say in the past, haven't we, like, oh, this is a toast to anyone who was affected, or try to keep, you know, we try and keep it as light as possible, because it's a fun event at the end of the day. but yeah, I mean, to be fair, some of the links we've done with the wine might have been not as sensitive as it could have been. That rosé that I paired with the woman who died after falling off of a cliff, and I paired it with, and I was so proud of myself,
Echo
and I was
Falls.
Like, this is excellent, guys. No, it was a rosé that was made in a winery in Mallorca, and this winery is built over lots of, it's several floors, and the whole point then is it's called like gravity method fermentation. So instead of using pumps to force the wine across all these different floors, it just kind of like gradually falls down. Yeah. And I was like, and you know, much like she, that's how she died, from gravity.
Chin chin.
Like, oh,
look, we can all set sensitivity aside for a good pun, all right? It doesn't matter. So that's okay.
Yeah. But I do think it's that separation of time. Like, I think that separation of time is really important, because, like, that's what I was saying. Like, yeah, if it's something more modern, you just, it's too real. And whereas this is history, and I think that's the entertainment factor of it. On that theme, then, how do you pick, like, what historical crime you're going to choose? So we know what you're not picking. We mentioned that explicitly, what you're not doing. But do you look for, like, certain themes or, like, locations or, like, anything specific?
So it sort of starts with the theme that we want to do for the evening. So Valentine's Day is usually, like, bad romance or something like that, and a bit more spooky or supernatural around Halloween, and then maybe we'll do another event during the year that's got a different theme. And because I have so many of these cases already, I think I've got, so, like, go to the archives, photograph a whole bunch of stuff, and then come home and transcribe it and do whatever it is I do with them. I have over 500 cases, I think between 500 and 600 cases just on my laptop. Wow. So I'm quite familiar with them. And I mean, some of them are quite straightforward and boring. Some of them are really, really rich and detailed. Usually if there's lots and lots of pretrial records, you know there's a good story to be told in there. So I basically just have a bank of these, and we'll start talking about an idea.
You've got plenty to go off then. Yeah,
we loads once, to go off.
I think maybe towards the end of our first season, we had like a crisis where we went, what if you run out of stuff? And then we realised just quite how long history actually is. And we were like, this is actually quite a lot to go off. It's fine.
It's loads of stuff.
You'll be fine. History, man.
Yeah, you'll be fine.
I went to university in Aberystwyth, and the library there I just find so cool. Have you got to go in there and like search about?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I spend loads of time there. I was actually up there last weekend. I spend tons of time there going through, just ordering up. Yeah, it's great. It's and like, I'm not down in the archives or anything. I'm in the search room like everyone else. But
it definitely sounds like you're in the dark with a candle. Yeah. Like, because you're like, oh, I can't take any food or drink in there. And I'm sorry, I'll call you back. I'm so dehydrated. I need to just get some food. And I'm like, what? Where are you?
Yeah, I get like hyper focused, and like, you have to go out, and in order to leave, someone has to push a button to let you go. So I feel bad having them do that all the time. So I just, I write it out, and then end up really dehydrated. But like, so yeah, I spend loads of time there, and it's, what's really cool about it is you order up all these documents in advance, and there are the actual old records from the sittings of the court, and the court sat twice per year in each county. And at the end of each session, they'd wrap up all the paperwork in a huge piece of vellum, tie it with a string, and they just, nobody ever thought to do anything with them. So earlier in the 20th century, they ended up originally at the National Archives at Kew, and then they were transferred back to the National Library of Wales. So there's these sometimes really chaotic old bundles of paper that nobody filed properly. And if you're touching them, and like, your hands are getting dirty from them, and they're getting dirty with like 18th century grime.
I love that.
Which is kind of gross, but also like,
that's
really,
music
really
to
cool.
our ears. That we were always on about touching like old castles and
exactly.
like Roman things, but it's touched like
18th
century grime. That's not the bad thing.
Yeah,
ye olde grime. But yeah, like, your hands are absolutely filthy by the time like you're done handling.
Filthy
things,
with history, the best dirty, kind of filth.
Historical filth.
Yeah, historical filth.
Best kind. I literally have a PhD in that.
That's Angela's, you know, that is her bag. And this is why, you know, Dr. you were Smith. Saying that you were a little intimidated first, honestly, when she's like, you know, you find out the amount of knowledge and everything else that this woman has. And I'm like, I drink wine for a living.
I was going to say, another dream job. There's two dream jobs.
I know, you've just said the two best jobs in the world.
it's pretty cool.
18th century grime and drinking wine. Why not?
Yeah. So that leads us then, ready for our example, if you're both ready to take us on for that.
Yeah,
we'll
for sure.
We'll hand over to you two.
Great, thank you. So yeah, this is one of the stories we used at our very first Wines and Crimes. And so it's set in Llanfair Cariainan in Mid Wales. It's now Powys, but it was Montgomeryshire. So in 1734, just outside the town of Llanfair Cariainan was, and still is to this day, this little farm called Dutrawen at the bottom of a hill. And one evening, a peddler walked down this hill and he was getting weary. It was the end of the day.
What's a peddler, Angela?
Oh, good question, Sarah. So a peddler was basically like a ye olde door-to-door salesman.
Ooh.
So he'd have like
peddling his wares. Is that where it comes from?
Peddling his wares. Exactly. Peddling his wares. Yeah. So it was an itinerant salesperson who would usually carry some like big pack full of goods, and they'd go parish to parish and door to door selling their wares. And so this one fella's out late one night and he's getting tired. And so he calls in at this farmhouse, which, in addition to being a farm occupied by a family, it was an informal alehouse and inn. So, you know, they'd welcome people in who were willing to pay a little bit and have a bite to eat and just bunk in with the family for the night. And that's what this peddler did. John Ray was his name. And he called in with them. He had dinner with them that night. And as they were chatting, John told the family that he paid £4 a year to the king. And by that, he meant that he paid to have a peddler's license. And £4 a year in 1734 would have probably been about like £400 today. So paying £400 for license means you're probably doing okay. So they figured, well, here's this old fella who's paying enough to have a license to peddling. He's doing it as a proper trader. And it looks like his pack's quite big. So, okay, they noticed that. Family turned in. Everyone goes to bed, including the peddler. And the husband and wife, Margaret and Evan, they're lying in bed, and Margaret says, "It's like, did you notice how big that peddler's sack was? It was pretty looked pretty beefy." And they had a chat about that. And they thought, you know, if there's enough in there, I think that might be a solution to our problem. So why don't we kill him? why don't we just Classics. No one will miss him from this like super creepy isolated farm at this bottom of this valley in Mid Wales. So yeah, why don't we just kill him? So the next morning they wake up. They send their two sons out of the house. The husband sends them out on a task saying, oh, go catch and kill a hare. And then the wife goes and gets the axe and hands it to her husband. And he goes in and just drops the axe right on the peddler's head. And he falls to the floor. And they end up finishing him off, dragging him out, hiding his body in the barn. And then they go and they open up his pack and they find next to nothing in it.
He's been duped.
He's been tricked. Yeah, so he's well dead by this point. And they find a little bit of cloth in there, and that's it. So the wife Margaret just decides that, well, she's just going to make some brand new shirts for her husband.
I already got some cloth, for God's sake.
As you do. So they got some cloth out of it. And then they take the poor peddler's body out to a field at the edge of their property, this little wooded field, and they bury his body one night. And then the wife says, Margaret says to Evan, it's like, well, you know what? We're going to hell. We're definitely going to hell for this.
Yeah.
And we didn't really make much off of him. So why don't we wait until there's another peddler coming along, and let's just make sure he's got like a really big pack. So he's got a lot in there, and we'll just kill him too. Because, you know, we're already going to hell for it once. Why don't we just keep at it? So the husband's like, all right, sure. Yeah, that's not a bad idea. And what really frustrated
in for a pound, yeah,
exactly. Might as well, right?
Does she not know the Lord forgiveth? Jesus,
I mean, there was comes a point where she was really hoping he was. Margaret gets mad at one point because Evan's away for work, and this peddler with a big juicy pack comes walking down the road, but she's got no one to help her kill the guy. So he gets off.
Sorry, yeah.
Big juicy pack.
Big juicy pack. Come on. You know what you're doing.
Yeah. Canadians, I had no idea.
I know.
Right?
Pure filth.
This is what I'm working with.
All the stereotypes. This wasn't one I was aware of.
Yeah. You don't know that that's not what the records actually say.
That's true. Some of the records are pretty spicy, aren't they? Yeah.
Have you looked at
them? Some smutty legal hand from the 1700s going, a big juicy pack.
I am fluent in 18th century legal smut. Okay.
Yeah, they knew
me,
the assignment.
Trust me, I'm a doctor. Yeah. So a little time passes and Evan's back home. And sure enough, there's another peddler coming down the road who's also named John, coming down. And he's a younger strapping lad who's carrying a much heavier peddler's bag on his back, if you prefer.
no, and juicy's good.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Go back to juicy.
Go back to juicy. That, yeah.
He's got a bigger, juicier sack. Okay. what I will say is we had one of our, this is just an aside, one of our stories from our last Wines and Crimes, which is just a couple days ago, there was a coroner involved and he was examining a body and he made comments on the man's scrotum.
Oh yeah.
The number of times that night I said scrotum. So like,
it's a horrible word, scrotum. It's such a horrid word.
Especially when they're putrefied. But anyway, so you're so you're getting off light with big juicy sack. Anyway,
yeah.
back to the story. So Margaret clocks this peddler coming down the road, and she calls to her husband. It's like, right, we need to get ready. Let's get this guy. So she runs in the house to bring him in to say, yeah, no, I'd love to see what you have to sell. And John sends his sons, or John, sorry, Evan sends his sons away so that they're not there to witness this. And they go in the house. They ask this peddler to spread out all of his wares on the kitchen table. And as he's doing that and setting it up, Evan picks up the axe and comes up behind him and just brings it down in one whack on his head and kills this peddler in a single stroke.
Man loves an axe.
He loves an axe.
He's getting good at it these days. Yeah. Practice makes perfect. Yeah.
He's a single death. Stroke.
Yes. No, single sorry. Stroke and they got everything right. In the basement.
You're reaching now.
We all went there though.
We did. Yeah.
We just add the I don't know, politeness not to say it.
Thing is, it's hard because like the language of violence and the language of like true. Innuendo, they're really similar.
Yeah.
Like when you, So yeah, I could try to not, but
No, don't do it.
It's part of the fun.
Back to the story. So as they're cleaning up this mess and trying to put away all this stuff, one of the couple's sons.
Thanks, come on, mate.
Sorry. I put myself on mute.
Sorry,
I was gonna say how many of you had?
I'll rephrase that. So as they're mopping up. No, I'm sorry. as they're sorting themselves out. Oh, I just.
We're never going to finish this.
No, we're not. Oh, right.
I realized what I did there. Never mind.
So they lit a cigarette. So as they're cleaning up the evidence from their violent crime,
there we go. Clinical terms.
Yeah. Isn't it horrible that's safer?
Yeah.
As they're clearing the evidence, one of their sons actually comes in and sees the blood on the floor, the peddler's wares on the table, and hears the last. Gurgling breaths of the dying man on the floor, and asks his parents, like, what's going on? What have you done here? And they say, never mind your business. Just go on your way. And that's the last we know that they talked about it. And so they clear out the body, put him in the barn again. And then later in the night, bury the body again beside where the other peddler was buried. And then they go about trying to get rid of everything that they now have, which, you know, they've got a lot of cloth, they've got a lot of household goods, they've got all of these different things that they're going to try and sell to make a lot of money.
we need great. To sell this.
Do you know how many shirts we can make from this? snazziest shirts in all of Llanfair Cariannon.
Also, I was going to say, like, they're not an inquisitive bunch, are they, back in the 1700s, the kids? Well, just don't worry about it. Yeah, right, cool.
Don't worry. Okay,
I'll come back to my room.
Thanks. And well, what they end up doing is they decide that the easiest things to get rid of or to try and sell is the cloth, but all of the other objects that he was carrying, and we don't actually know what that was. We just know that they ended up burning it. So they kill this guy to try and make to get rich, and they end up burning most of the stuff and trying to sell the cloth.
Their minds up, can they? They were gutted about having cloth, and now they're burning everything but the cloth.
I know, right? Make up your mind.
So
Margaret, the wife, sets about trying to shift some of these goods, and that's when suspicion starts to fall on them. So she just goes basically walking to her neighbor saying, oh, do you want some cloth? I bought it for myself, but I don't really like it. Or she tells one neighbor girl, she's like, I bought this handkerchief for myself, but I think it would suit you more than me, and sells it to this girl.
It's speckled and this girl's with red polka dots. Don't worry about that.
Yeah,
it's Vogue at the moment.
Yeah. Bloodstains are all the rage in 1734. It's 1735 by this point. And this young woman is noted wearing this new handkerchief in church one day.
Yeah, it all comes out in church.
Yeah. Exactly. All the hot goss in church.
Exactly. It's probably that whole like God factor too.
Yeah.
Might have something to do with it.
Not too long later, the brother of one of the peddlers comes looking for his brother and follows his trade route and gets to this town where he's looking for his brother who is selling particular wares. Meanwhile, there's this town where everyone is wearing new particular wares. And they're like, oh, where did you get that from? That looks like the stuff my brother was selling. So Margaret leaves town. She runs across the border. She runs to Shrewsbury. The locals gather with their pitchforks and shovels and everything, and they descend on the property of this couple out down to the farm, and they start digging, and they find the bodies. Margaret runs off to Shrewsbury. She's arrested there. They end up arresting Evan as well, and they end up arresting the eldest son as well. And at that point, all three are charged with the murders of these peddlers. And then in an interesting, well, not really interesting twist, but we know so much about this because both Evan and Margaret give full confessions. So full and detailed. These are their own words that tell us this. And we fill in the blanks through some of the other witness statements. So they're arrested and they're charged. And normally during a wine and crimes, that's where I'd end the story for now and move on to the next one. Because at the end, we have everyone guess what they think happened. And then Sara will do the reveal about why she's paired the wine to it. But I can just go on and say here now. But what do you lads think happened to Evan and Margaret? Do you think they were found guilty or do you think they may have been innocent?
Can I ask a question before? Like, when you say that,
yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, like today you'd have like, they'd record the time and then they'd record you saying what you say. Do they like scribe it all down verbatim of what they said and then you as a historian can read the words they said, or is it like a gist of like of what the police
that's said? A really good question. It's more of a gist, and there's also the element of translation involved, so we don't actually know if the person whose statement this is, if they were speaking Welsh or English, because English was the language of administration post Acts of Union, and it's the exactly. And it's the Acts of Union that established the courts of Great Session. So everything is translated.
Like the look of someone, you could just translate and go, "I totally did it. It was me, 100%."
Exactly.
Is it quite uncommon to have like them confessing? Because I always think you could get away with literal murder in the past if you were a scoundrel, because there's no DNA, there's no cameras.
Yeah.
But then I suppose everyone knows each other a bit more. And if you're identified because you sold a hanky, maybe that is like 18th century CCTV in action.
Well, it is interesting. In Wales, the conviction rate, especially for capital offences, so anything that involved the death penalty, was exceptionally low. Like surprisingly low.
So a lot of gold. That's why. Just exactly. Naturally born.
Nobody wants to wrestle their neighbour.
So there's this phrase that Wales was known as the land of white gloves, and what that means is if there was a sitting of the court that resulted in absolutely no death penalties being handed out, the sitting justice would put on white gloves, and it would be called a maiden session. So Wales was referred to as the land of white gloves, which makes it sound like it was really innocent and not violent at all. But actually, there's a couple theories about this where the reason why there were so few capital convictions in Wales, at least at that time, was either one theory is because there was a reluctance of local Welsh juries, and they would all be, the juries would all be made up of local Welsh people.
So was that still the same?
Also spoke English.
Sorry to jump in. Was it still the same that you'd have like a jury of 12 good men and true, and they'd preside over it?
Okay. You'd actually have two juries. You'd have a grand jury and a trial jury. So the grand jury sits first, and they're usually higher status men. And they're the ones who look at the formal charge document, at the indictment, and they decide whether or not there's actually enough evidence to go to trial. So they'd find that bill of indictment true or not true. If they don't think there's enough evidence to bother with trial, they'll throw that out. And then there's a trial jury, and they're the ones who decide guilt or not guilty. So
sort of similar to the modern thing where, like, if the CPS at the Crown Prosecution Service, if they don't think there's enough to hold anyone on or whatever, or to charge,
grand jury is similar to CPS, except this would happen on the same day or at the same sitting of the court.
Right, okay.
You go from one straight to the other. But these are all locals. Both juries would be made up of locals. So there's one theory that says there was sort of like colonial resistance saying, well, we don't want to be administering English law in Wales and killing our own. By the 18th century, I don't think that's the case because, I mean, the grand jury and the trial jury, they're part of the establishment. So why would they care about that?
Yeah.
But the other... the other argument, which I sort of buy a bit more, is that you deal with your own. So the person that's done this horrible thing, well, you know them and you know, you might rough them up a bit, or they might get roughed up a bit. They'd have a talking to, but you don't really want to see them go to the gallows. So because there's such tight knit communities, you just kind of look after your own, even if it's someone who's a bit.
We mentioned quite a bit, but Wales. Right. It's very community focused and in loads of aspects, like during COVID and stuff, like Merthyr Tydfil had high rates of COVID, and they suspect it's because the community culture of like giving someone a hug and all that stuff kind of just was just too ingrained. It's too hard not to be connected to each other. So I could see that a lot. It's so fun as well.
Exactly.
Having an actual historian on the lines who can tell us real stuff.
We'll have so many questions.
Yeah, I know.
This is where it's like, I really wish I could think of something like two truths and a lie. tell you something completely wrong.
I can tell already that our listeners are going to love this episode. So we're going to definitely have to get you both back to give some more wine, some more crimes.
Anytime. We didn't give our prediction, Franco.
Do you think they were guilty or innocent?
They're guilty as sin. Listen to them.
They're definitely guilty. Yeah. But something to tell me from what you said earlier about we look after our own. There's something that just pinged something in my head then. Did they maybe get off with it, but then the locals did some sort of vigilante
They've not mentioned the son. Like, Angie's not mentioned that the son hasn't said anything, has he?
Three of them were tried. Three of them were
so. Did the son maybe dob the other two in it and say, look, maybe I was paying attention?
Did they dob the son in? Did they say, oh, our son's a mad lad? And they just grassed him up.
It was him all along.
Well, he just don't learn so good.
He's a backwards boy.
Yeah.
He sure does
love swinging that axe. That's all I know.
Chop, chop, chop.
Do you mean our son Axel?
Named after the loving wood axe, of course.
So, Sarah, do you know the answer?
We've done this all right.
So,
and it's also all the wines that I choose are often linked to. Results as well.
Yeah. So, Jack, I'm going to say they stitched up Axel and threw him to the mercy of the judges. They're like, we ain't done nothing around here, my lord.
So what are you saying? Interesting. I'm going to say Axel came through with he was the bombshell in court that got them convicted.
Okay. So
that one's closer, but not quite. So, so Margaret and Evan, they're both found guilty. And Axel, who wasn't, I think his name was Evan. I can't remember. But the son wasn't even tried. Oh. But he did provide one of these statements, and he threw his parents under the bus. But the parents also threw themselves under the bus. So with something like this, it's likely that they confessed in full to save their son. If what they say is true, their son didn't have any involvement but was implicated as a witness. So they confessed in full, and they were both hanged. And there's a couple of things about this crime that have essentially etched themselves on the landscape. So if you look at a map, if you go on Google Maps and type in Gibbet Road, I think it's Gibbet something. I can't remember if it's Gibbet Road.
Gibbet Road.
Yeah, Gibbet Road and Gibbet Hill. They're named after where the gibbet. So once you're hanged, a body is sometimes gibbeted, so hung in like an iron cage or chained as a deterrent. That's what a gibbet is. So he was gibbeted.
Right.
She wasn't. They didn't tend to gibbet women because women's bodies, we can't look at those.
Are they red house firm?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it red house firm? Yeah, can you Google
it's near there. So it's a private farm. Back in the day it was called Utruwen, but there's a campsite just below it.
Yeah.
Just where you wanted to camping.
I know, I've kind of always wanted to go camping there. But that's so they were hanged and he was gibbeted on the hill overlooking the farm. Wow. And apparently, in local lore, there's a field, and I've looked this up. I haven't been able to find this. So apparently it's local tradition. The reason I've looked this up and can't find it, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Royal Commission, the Ancient and Historical Monuments of Wales. They have a historic place name database where you can look up old, like ancient place names in Wales, and it'll pin it on a map.
Oh, wow.
So
that sounds like a resource we should be using.
Well, it's so cool.
The etymology, I'm obsessed with the etymology of stuff. I think it's so interesting. Yeah. That's history. Like words, like especially Welsh words, tell you so much about an area. So gibbets are cool. I'm writing that down to tell other people.
So if you put that in this database, it comes up there too. But apparently, in local lore, the fields where the two peddlers were buried is known as Gwerglod y Pimbev.
So we know that two definitely. We know two died, but apparently there's Pimp Bedd. There's five graves there.
And in Welsh, bedd is grave, isn't it? And pimp is the number five.
Yeah, so it's basically like the meadow. In local Welsh lore, it's known as the meadow of the five graves.
Ooh,
but we only know of two. So I don't know if that's historical inflation or if the locals knew more than we did, but.
Or if just more people murdered people and kept burying in the same place. Well, this is obviously a good burial ground. Let's add to it.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, they stumbled upon us. Two people buried here already, and you just chuck them in here.
It's a good space. Yeah, why not?
Yeah. And there is a campsite, right? I'm on Google Maps right now, and Pentre Penard campsite. Wow, that's cool.
Just right above that is the farm. I was just going to say, what I love about a lot of these stories is they give really specific details of locations, whether they're little settlements or farmsteads, and they're ancient names. And if you look on maps, sometimes they're still there. There was one I was looking up the other day, and I think it's Anglesey or North Wales somewhere. And the only evidence of it, of that place name, is now there's like a dog kennel that has kept the name of that farm. And so that's the only way you can find out where it is. But there's loads of detail about historic place names in these records.
Well, me and Frank, we were always saying about how like some of the stuff we cover, and don't get me wrong, half of it is down to our lack of deep diving. But the other half is like because there isn't, it's very vague sometimes, especially when you go way, way back. In the like old battles or old sort of historic events where stuff wasn't written down as well and things like that. So I imagine having that level of detail must be good, because like we'd love sometimes we want to really know what happened to a certain person or the outcome of a certain event, and we just can't find it because it just isn't there.
But we love it, like the etymology, like for Cardiff, for example. Caerdydd in Welsh, like Caer means like fortress or like stronghold, and then Dyff is the river Taff, and like so now it's called Cardiff. And then if I drove down like Gibbet Road, I just think, oh, this is a quaint, funny little name, and to now know that it's named after the way someone is brutally hung out to dry.
His insides were hung for you to see. Lovely.
Wow.
Romanticize the old times, don't we? And then you think, well, it would have been quite grim, actually.
We weren't murdering peddlers, so I think we'd be all right.
That's true.
Well, you just don't know.
They might have been really
annoying. You know what you would have done.
You sound like one of those, like, oh, I've done nothing, do nothing wrong, nothing to fear. You're one of them guys. Don't end up in gibbet.
other than the violent axe murder, I think like the thing that would bother me the most about living back in the past is just the smell.
Yeah,
I think about that way too often.
No links back.
It's one
then.
Of those things that I'm like, why is this taking up space in my brain? Yeah, I feel like the past would smell.
If you, either of you, Sarah, if you could go back to one moment in history, what time would you go back to?
Oh, do you know what? I don't even know where to begin, actually.
Angie, you like start. We'll come back to you in a second, Sarah.
Ooh. I've got two, if that's okay. Like, one, I just love to see a sitting of the Great Sessions, just because I talk about it so much, and it would be great to see if I actually am right.
Yeah, that'd be fun. Yeah.
But I think it would actually be incredible to go back and hear, like, Beethoven or Mozart performed live.
Oh,
because
yeah.
Like if you're living at that time and lucky enough to go and hear like a live symphony, you hear it once and that's it. You'll never hear it again.
The original gigs.
Would have been amazing to hear it like with the composers involved in it. So I think
that's nice.
That's a
very very good answer.
Spoken like a true professional.
Yeah, so true.
A little too
I much. Live in the past, though. I don't even know what year it is now.
All right. Well, in which case, right, I would either go back to the Great Prohibition in the States, because I feel like I could probably get really crafty in making
moonshine.
Distilling like I know you've done in the past.
You'd be such a baller.
Shit in my bath and then selling it. Yeah. I'm quite creative.
You would be so good at that.
And I think I would make bank.
Be like a mob boss.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, small but mighty.
100%.
Or I don't know. I'm feeling like a pull to like our Welsh history and, you know, wanting to be involved in some sort of Owain Glyndŵr uprising or something. Mm. Just to be able to wield a sword.
Gwenllian's like right hand woman.
Yeah.
I'd probably have to cut my hair and pretend to be a man, but that's fine.
Well, you know, Welsh culture used to have a lot of women
back
fighters.
Then you would be right. Yeah, you'd be fine.
So like Gwenllian, like you mentioned, she was a warrior princess, and all the way back to like the Celts, there was always Welsh shield maidens. I'd go history
and
as well.
Shield maidens.
Yeah.
The number of these records that I look at where it's like, and the moral of the story is don't fuck with Welsh women.
Yeah, that's how the Vikings never really settled. Because when the Vikings tried to take Welsh women, there was too much of a pushback, as in like they were proper warriors themselves. So they were like, oh, this is a lot of hard work. It was too difficult. Mm. So they used to struggle an awful lot. And that's why Wales never really got taken over by the Vikings. Plus we had like a leader called Rodri Mawr who kicked their ass a little bit. But
we had at the end of the battle of Bryglas with it was Owain Glyndŵr, I believe. Right?
Yeah,
correct me if I'm wrong. The the women afterwards, because of the like hurt the English had done on the Welsh women of the country, they went to every deceased Englishman, cut off their tallywhackers, and popped them in their mouths.
in the dead person's mouth, not their own mouth.
Sorry, I should have enunciated a little bit better there.
Yeah.
Sorry, in the corpse's mouth. Sorry,
not just
their
taking
own
notes
mouth.
Here.
That would have been mental, but I mean, it's mental enough. But but just as a display of like, don't fuck with us type thing. So they were forced to be reckoned with.
Amen.
And we've also said Welsh mothers are the best. Me and Jack have great Welsh mums, shit Welsh dads. Mm. So we always talk about the power of real Welsh women.
I can vouch for that.
Yeah, I think most of Wales can vouch for that. All right, so what would the wine
it's
be
fine,
then?
My dad doesn't listen to podcasts. So.
Yeah, my dad can't listen to podcasts. And he wouldn't listen to mine anyway, so it's absolutely fine. what would be the next step then if we were at a live Wine and Crimes right now then? So we've just found out that they were gibbeted.
We've missed out the wine pairing. So.
Yeah. Yes.
So during, basically, while Angela is telling everyone about the true crime, that's when a wine is served and there's like a little presentation, not a presentation. I'll literally just say, this is called this. And I'll try and drop some clues or some hints. More often than not, it's to throw people off, and it just for the panto effect, because I think people enjoy it when we get a bit panto, don't they? Mm-hmm. And so at this point, that's when I would say, right, so for example, this wine that we are drinking alongside the Lidl version, which is not great, actually, but it doesn't matter. So we are drinking a Lleidr, which means the thief. It is a Welsh wine from the Del Vineyard in Monmouthshire. And the reason, obviously, so the story talks about people murdering to steal, being the thief, a Lleidr. But the reason this wine is called a Lleidr is because during their very first harvest a couple of years ago, Dan and Lucy, the owners of the vineyard, they decided to take a little break before picking the grapes because it's such a massive, monumental job. They were like, let's just go camping for a few days with a little one, like unwind, just switch off, and then we'll come back and we'll start grafting. And then by the time they came back, most of the grapes had been just munched through by blackbirds and badgers.
Oh, no.
It's a real, it's a real thing. So they only managed to make 130 bottles of wine, which is not great for a vineyard owner. And so they named, and actually the wine ended up being an award-winning one, and it was absolutely incredible. And so they named it a Lleidr, and on the label, it's even got this little blackbird. It's got some gold leaf kind of
I'm looking at it now. It looks beautiful.
Yeah, it's really, really cool. And so the link here, obviously, is a Lleidr, meaning the thief, like the couple. Blackbirds generally tend to be some sort of symbolism for endings and beginnings. Often an omen of death. Obviously, there's a lot of death in the story.
Oh, yeah, and a group of them is a murder.
Oh, is that
crow? Oh, a group of crows. Yeah,
well done.
Yeah.
Well done.
I didn't even get that. And, well done. Yeah. It's obviously a Welsh wine, as is the story. And the annoyingly, it's a little further north than I would have liked, because I used to stock wines from Montgomeryshire, which is where the story is from. And this is where I like to throw in a third, more tenuous link. It is quite a fruity wine, so you get lots of summer fruits and like wild strawberry, raspberry. So fruity, much like what were they called again?
Margaret and Evan.
Margaret and Evan must have been feeling quite fruity in their decision making that night, thinking we're just gonna kill a guy fruity. For his stuff.
Fruity is such a great adjective to describe.
Sweet word to describe for murder. Oh, yeah. I've been a bit fruity.
The fruity night, smack an axe into a guy's head. Yeah.
It did say tenuous. This is the point where people go, oh, I never would have gotten that. And you go, well, you know.
And don't blackbirds steal or crows steal things for their nest?
Yeah, they do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's why it's called Lleidr. They've already got that link.
It's very odd.
Frank, I'm a genius.
Hang on, Lleidr is thief.
We've just gone full circle.
Yeah. Well, that was brilliant. Thank you so much. That was so fun. Yeah. When's the next one coming up, and how can people find you?
So the next one, we're planning it. We'll have one maybe like May or June. I think we've not worked out the details of it just yet, but I really want to do one that focuses on stories of ye olde sex workers.
Oh, yeah.
Because I've got some incredible ones, and that's, including Cardiff Mary. And I've got a story from Carnarvon.
Perfect opportunity to drop all your euphemisms in as well.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's one from Carnarvon in 1751 or 1752. I only remember that because it has to do with like just after the passing of a certain piece of legislation. But one of the women involved in it is just called Martha Vower, which I love.
Big Martha.
Here she is.
There's one of the customers in that brothel is Will Assize.
English Will.
Yeah, he's
Will.
A sailor.
English Willie
the sailor. So I want to, I think something, so we might do something around, give it like a ye olde name, so something around like strumpets and bods, and that I think will be May or June.
We'll have to get you back on just before that then as well.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, once we've got this is because this is the creative stage where we sit down and drink wine and talk about ideas and the fun stage.
Yeah.
But this is why the events end up being so good is because we enjoy the creative stage of it. So, but if anyone wants to find out about the event before it even comes out, then the website for Vin Van Company, vinvancompany.co.uk, or they can sign up to the newsletter because I do tend to send out an exclusive email out to people who are interested, because we the last one was we sold out quite quickly, didn't we?
Back in October.
So yeah, if people are interested, then that's probably, and just follow us on socials, Vin Van Cymru. And Angela's handle is my favorite. What's your handle, Angela?
So my surname is Muir, so my handle is Murder, she wrote.
Oh, very nice. Beautiful. Very nice.
Yeah. We'll put all the links in our
send,
in our
yeah,
episode.
Send these links. Yeah, yeah, we'll pop them in the pod notes so everyone will be there ready to go.
And I already know this will be a fan favorite. That was really, really good fun. So, Dirk and Val, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, guys. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
All right, then. So don't forget to drop us a 5-star review and all that malarkey. I can't be bothered. I hate doing this bit.
No, same. Yeah.
Bye.
I just left it to you. Yeah, bye.
Bye.
Tell it.